This is a Radio.com original.
This is KNX In Depth. I'm Mike Simpson.
And I'm Charles Feldman. Churches and the faithful are both getting anxious to get back to in-person services, both here in California and around the country. Some churches here plan to open up their doors soon and before Governor Newsom wants them to. The Department of Justice even sent the governor a letter warning him that he's violating constitutional rights. So we will go in depth into the reopening of churches, and we'll also hear from a priest who has practiced social distancing with squirt guns. And it's not just churches that are planning to reopen. Courts across the country have been figuring out ways to open up again and keep everyone from getting infected with COVID-19. Now, one county in Northern California thinks it has things figured out, and it's planning on getting back to some kind of normal next week. And President Trump has been maligned and criticized for wanting to reopen the economy and get people back to work. He's also been slammed for touting hydroxychloroquine and comparing this pandemic to a bad flu season. But has the president actually been right all along? New data and numbers show maybe he was about certain things.
Weather's getting nicer, warmer. The holiday weekend's coming up. People are not just going to stay inside. Many planning to go to the beach. So whether sunbathing and feeling the nice ocean breeze or swimming, is there a higher risk to the virus out there? We'll go in depth on potential dangers on the sands. And despite calls to unite and help each other out to get through this, people are still being jerks to each other. Arguments still erupting on social media and in person about mask wearing, reopening the economy, you name it. People are fighting about it still. Why can't we all just get along?
We should do a whole show one day on why are some people jerks. We should.
We'll take calls. We can all argue together.
Yeah. Back to churches, though. With us now is Father Tim Pilk of St. Ambrose Parish in Grosse Pointe Park. That's in Michigan. He gained some internet fame by using a squirt gun filled with holy water on Easter to keep in line with social distancing.
So many people saw the pictures.
I love that one. And we have Danny Carroll, who's a senior pastor at Water of Life Community Church in Fontana, who plans to reopen his church at the end of the month, despite the governor's orders to remain closed. Thank you both for being with us. Appreciate it. So, Father Pilk in Michigan, let's start with you. Just very quickly, since we mentioned it, the squirt gun thing, just how did that come about and how did it work out?
It was an idea that was meant to help kids in the parish have some semblance of a happy Easter. Blessing of the Easter baskets is a tradition here, and it started, of course, right at the beginning of the shutdown, and so I strategized with a couple of the doctors in the local hospitals, and that's what we came up with, and that was supposed to be the end of it.
Well, hardly. So much for
but
that.
But the internet had other plans. Yeah. You are now. You've been
so much for
a thousand
that.
Times. Yeah.
So tell us now about holding Mass. How is this going to work out, and when is it going to work out, and how are you going to do it?
Here in the Detroit area?
Yeah.
We are allowed to do public Masses starting this weekend. We must resume them the following weekend, the Memorial Day weekend. Seemed okay until I began to think about it, and we're trying to find a way of following all of the directives that are attached to that. And I'm more than a little nervous. I have a sense that we may be rushing this. And I think people are going to be very disappointed when they come, because the Mass that they participated in back in March is going to be very different than the Mass as it's going to be done now.
Yeah, a lot of things you just can't do the same way anymore. In terms of capacity or mask wearing, social distancing, how do you think that's going to shake out?
We're allowed 25% of the capacity of the building with 6-foot intervals in between congregants. Everyone needs to wear a mask. And that pretty well kills any kind of congregational singing. I guess you could hum into your mask, but choirs are eliminated for now. As any kind of socializing before or after Mass is eliminated. Like I said, this is going to be a pretty solitary type of liturgy.
Okay, so now, Danny Carroll, you're planning to reopen your church at the end of the month, right? Even though the governor's orders here in California are to remain closed. What's the rationale?
Yeah, that's correct. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I was saying, what's the rationale for doing that?
Well, we've been very patient. We work with the governor's office. We sent in a 12-page plan for reopening that his COVID-19 task force said was excellent. But don't hold your breath because it's not going to happen anytime soon. So our question is how come we can stand in the aisle at Home Depot with 10 people with masks on? And yesterday I got a picture of a Southwest Airlines flight. One of my members sent me a picture of them on a Southwest Airlines flight to Dallas with wall-to-wall people. Nobody had a mask on. And I know we can do way better than that. So the question really, and the Department of Justice spoke to this in their letter to Governor Newsom, was, why can't churches do what everybody else is doing? We don't think that we're going to put people in danger. We care about our people immensely, and our intent is to do as Father Tim's going to do. We're going to use probably 10% of our auditorium. We have 3,300 seats in our auditorium, so we'll probably put 300 to 330 people in there, and everybody will wear a mask. Our churches, our chairs are already spread throughout the church there, throughout the sanctuary, and socially distanced, so people will just come in and sit down, either in family groups or individually, and be socially distanced with masks on. So we're excited. We want to get back to it. We've been out for 9 weeks now, and our people have worked really hard. We feed about 10,000 people a week out of our food warehouse and take meals to people, shut-in seniors and different people. But our folks are really hungry for fellowship. They're hungry to worship. They're hungry to go live. And so we'll start with one small service on the first weekend, and then we intend, as soon as we shake it out and we know that we can do it well and we can do it safely, we intend to add services every week until we can get everybody back into fellowship together.
And any worries that anyone's going to try and shut you down if the rules do say that, no, you can't be open yet?
Well, we're working with our county and our county health department closely. We talk to them probably three times a week. We work with our county supervisors. If they had their way, they would let us roll right now. And they're hoping that Governor Newsom, because of this letter, will delegate the authority to them so they can let us go. That would be exciting for us. We really feel like we've made some headway here. The governor is moving quickly. 2 weeks ago, he said in a phone call, it'll be weeks and weeks before you're in. You're going to be lumped in with Major League Baseball, the NBA, and churches. Don't hold your breath because it's going to be weeks for you. And this week, he said, it'll be a short time. It'll be a matter of a couple of weeks, and we're going to let you come back. So, no, we're not really concerned. We're prepared. We prayed this through diligently. We really sought the Lord on it. We really think it's time for us to go, and it's Pentecost weekend. It's a great time to restart the church. It's when the church started in Acts chapter 2. It was on May 30th, 1st, and so we're excited to restart on that weekend.
And briefly, back to you, Father Tim, in Michigan, recognizing that they're not going to be able to do the things that they're used to doing. You mentioned no chorus, no socializing. But isn't it the case that some people, maybe many of the people there, will still feel some comfort just being able to go?
Yes, but I'm beginning to sense that it's not going to be as many as we anticipate, because as I'm trying to line up other ministers and ushers and things like that, I'm getting a lot of saying, no, not right now. So I thoroughly do not expect to be overwhelmed on this early opening.
Yeah. All right. Some people want to wait it out a little longer. Father Tim Pelk, St. Ambrose Parish in Michigan. If you haven't seen the pictures, he had the squirt gun with the holy water. It's on the internet. Easy to find. Danny Carroll, Senior Pastor, Water of Life Community Church in Fontana. Thanks to you both.
Also, Mike and I, of course, do our daily podcast about the coronavirus called Coronavirus Daily World on Pause. Get it wherever you get your podcast from. When KNX In-Depth continues, what will courtrooms look like in the middle of this pandemic? We will give you a kind of sneak peek. You're listening to KNX In Depth. Along with Mike Simpson, I'm Charles Feldman.
Reminder, still to come on the show, the beaches could be more crowded than they have been in a while. People looking to take advantage of the nicer weather and the holiday weekend. But is the beach a secret hotspot for the coronavirus.
Right now, though, courts across the country have been working on plans to reopen while making sure things are safe for everyone involved. Contra Costa County up in the Bay Area is planning to open its Superior Court back up next week after Memorial Day. What is going to happen there? What is it going to look like? How is it going to feel? Is it going to be safe? With us is Judge Barry Baskin, who's the Superior Court judge in Contra Costa County. Also joining us will be Mary McQueen, who's president of the National Center for State Courts. Both of you, thank you. So, Judge Baskin, I presume that you're going to start having jury trials. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but if you are, how do you intend to do that and keep social distancing and keep people feeling safe and comfortable?
Well, first of all, thank you for taking the time to find out about the many challenges facing our court. To answer your question, we are opening to the public on Tuesday, right after Memorial Day, but we only are starting jury trials for those trials that were actually in progress and interrupted by this closing of our courts on Tuesday. After that, by July 8th, we are starting up new trials. And yes, it is going to be a challenge, and I can tell you more about the challenges that we do face in enforcing the 6-foot distancing rule, in addition to keep our jurors and the entire courthouse safe. We've implemented a whole bunch of measures that are fairly strict, I think probably one of the strictest in the state, and I'm happy to go through that list if you want to hear
what
they
are. Take us through some of that. Let's say I'm one of those jurors, right, and my trial was interrupted, but I'm going to walk in, and what are you going to tell me?
Well, if you are already in a trial, that means you've already been through the jury selection process, and you would head up straight into the courtroom itself. I'm in a 3 co-defendant murder trial, and you would find the courtroom is completely rearranged. So jurors cannot sit in the jury box that we're all familiar with because 6 feet distancing does not accommodate that. I would have typically 12 jurors together with alternates. This is a long trial, so there's 6 alternates for a total of 18 jurors. They would need to occupy the spectator gallery at the back of the courtroom. So right there is a radical change in how the courtroom is arranged. For their safety, they have to be 6 feet from one another and from the lawyers and from potential witnesses.
How do you do things like before you become, let's go ahead to when new jurors are going to show up, okay? So
sure.
To get to jury selection, I don't know how it is up there. I know how it is down here in L.A. County. You usually get funneled into a room with like 100 other people sitting around for hours on end until they impanel a jury. And then you do have jury deliberations, which usually you're packed into another kind of tiny room to deliberate. How are you going to do all that?
Well, it sounds like you're describing our court before the pandemic, but it is going to be radically different on June 8th when we start up.
I got that. How?
Exactly. The jury assembly room normally houses about 250 to 300 people, but with social spacing, it can fit no more than 50 people. So the 50 people are going to line up and be let into that room in a manner that maintains the social distancing until 50 are seated. Because we can fit no more than 50 at a time, we're staggering the jury time. So the first group will arrive at 8, the next group will arrive at 10, the next group after that at 1, and the last group of the day will be at 3. Those jurors, as soon as they come in at 8, will be kept just long enough to funnel them into the courtrooms that need them, or they will be excused.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, you got to keep it moving. Judge, hang on there just a second. Let's bring in Mary McQueen, president of the National Center for State Courts. Mary, you like the plan that you're hearing from Contra Costa County? I know there have been every jurisdiction in the country sitting down with a whole bunch of papers and literally going through their courthouse floor plans because this has been a tough issue to try and tackle.
I think Contra Contra County, and Judge Baskin, I want to congratulate you on putting all the information on your website and getting it out to the public about what to expect. And I think that the guidelines that the court has put in place are those that we are, unfortunately, at this point in time, mostly aware of. But I don't think that jury selection, especially, is going to be traditional. And actually, on Monday of this week, we were part of a pilot in Texas where the entire jury selection was done virtually, where all the members of the panel, the 50 jurors that the judge was speaking of, actually was down to 28, and they participated totally virtually. Their jury summons, they were asked what type of device they wanted to use. Would they be using a laptop? Would they be using a smartphone? And the entire jury selection process was done virtually. I would have to say that it was a Zoom platform. We had two judges in the room. The judge who actually presiding over the selection process. And then we had a judge that was basically the technical advisor. And you say, well, why do you need a technical advisor, Mary? Well, because the judge is really interacting with the jury and the attorneys. The questioning process, just like the one that you would see in Judge Baskin's court. But what was really interesting to me is, and it may be a first, when Judge Baskin gave them the orientation, and it's the same thing, you know, you have privacy, you can't look on your cell phone, or you can't go on your browser and try to ask questions about facts that may come up in the trial. But what was interesting to me was when the judge said, is there anyone who does not want to participate on the jury? No one raised their hands. This was a first.
Now hold that thought, because I want to ask you, Judge, that question, because you're not doing it virtually. You're doing it in reality. People are coming into the courthouse. What are you going to do with a potential juror who says, you know what, I don't feel comfortable doing this. I've been doing a good job staying at home. I don't go shopping. I don't do any of those other things. I don't care that we're 6 feet apart. I just don't want to spend my day with a bunch of strangers, masks or no masks.
There's two responses to that question. The first is, on our website, you can become immediately excused in response to the jury summons if you are over the age of 60 or if you have any of the underlying vulnerable conditions that would make you a higher risk person. So that's the first answer to your question. The second answer is, if after coming into court, going up to my courtroom, and I'm sure all of the other judges in our county feel the same way, you said the things that you just said, you would be excused from jury duty.
Judge Barry Baskin there, Superior Court Judge, Contra Costa County. Mary McQueen, President of the National Center for States Courts. Thanks.
Now, when KNX In-Depth continues, the president may not be the most eloquent of speakers, and he's not certainly by any means a medical professional, but that doesn't mean that he's always wrong when it comes to COVID-19, or does it?
This is KNX In-Depth, along with Charles Feldman. I'm Mike Simpson.
Coming up a bit later, why are people being so mean to each other during this pandemic? What's driving all the anger and harassment?
Yeah, cut it out.
We're not mean to each other, you and I.
No, we're very nice.
We're really nice. When we're on the air. When we're not on the air, we're at it
staplers.
All the time.
Right now, though, the president has touted hydroxychloroquine as a key weapon to fight this virus. He's been pushing to reopen the economy and has been for a while, and then has been comparing this to a bad flu season. There's a lot of argument over all of that, but could he end up being right about at least some of it? Dr. David Eisenman, director of the Center for Public Health and Disasters and professor in residence, Community Health Sciences at the UCLA Fielding School of Public Health, and Dr. John Ioannidis, professor of medicine, epidemiology, population health at Stanford's School of Medicine, both with us.
Okay, let's begin with Dr. Ioannidis in Stanford, and we'll take one part of the president's argument. He has been very consistent in saying or at least suggesting that in the end, the mortality rate, as bad as it is not going to be significantly different than a very bad flu season. And just the other day here in L.A., they had a projection, and I think it was USC. I don't want to mention the wrong school, but I do think it was USC, that said that about 4.2%, they believed, of the county population in L.A. was already infected. So that would translate to roughly more than 400,000 people. And the death rate in L.A. County is about 1,900 when last I looked. So that would give a mortality rate in the county of L.A. significantly below 1%. Does that come kind of close to what the president has been saying?
I think that we have to be very cautious with this data because single studies are just giving us a fragment of the true picture. There's a very large number of seroprevalence studies that have been done already, both in our country and around the world. And some of them have already been released as full papers or as preprints. And we see quite the variability in the inferred infection fatality rate. In some locations like Japan, it's as low as 0.02%, which seems very improbable. Probably some deaths have been missed in that case. In other locations like Geneva, they're up to 0.4%. Which is substantially higher, and they reflect probably the fact that 60% of the deaths have happened in nursing homes. In locations like New York, it's likely that the infection fatality rate, even though there's no full paper yet, is much higher, in the range of 1% in some locations like Queens, or even higher. And it's probably not surprising because, again, we have lots of people who are vulnerable, who died in nursing homes. Actually, people with COVID-19 were transferred to nursing homes. We have poor disadvantaged populations that had a very heavy death toll. So it's not a one-size-fits-all. If things go well and if we can protect our nursing homes and if we can protect hospitals, we avoid nosocomial infections, we don't see the vulnerable populations being hit heavily, we can expect a pretty good outcome. In locations where the vulnerable population and vulnerable settings get hit hard, then you would expect a much higher death toll.
Dr. Eisenman, your thoughts on how this could eventually shake out? And I understand there's problems even asking that question because it's a wait and see how it eventually shakes out.
Yeah, well, I agree fully with Dr. Ioannidis. You know, we don't want to look at just one study. Science takes stutter steps back and forth. It's multiple studies. We're always replicating each other's methods and we're approaching the truth from a variety of angles. So we're getting, you know, the picture slowly. You know, this has been around for, 4 months now, this pandemic. We're still learning a lot from it. The infection fatality rate is going to vary between communities based on the ages in the community and the health of the community and other things that are going to lead to severity. So we got to be careful. All the studies have limitations too. The best papers that are published in the peer-reviewed journals, the authors will discuss the limitations of their results. So again, we have to look at them all together in aggregate, not any one single study like this.
But let me go back to the central question that we're asking is it turning out that what President Trump's position has been, and I want to try to leave, if we can, politics out of this, but just sort of look at the way the facts are stacking up. He was widely criticized initially because people were saying, well, the death rate for this thing is going to be maybe 2%, 3%, significantly more than flu. And yet, yes, there are different studies, and I get that there are different figures for different population groups. But when you take all the figures in aggregate, is it turning out to be closer to what his argument has been?
Well, yeah. I mean, in the beginning, I think there were claims and fears of fatality rates in the 2 and 3%. And early in an epidemic or pandemic, the fatality rate is going to look higher. So it's not surprising that it might be coming down. You know, we need good meta-analyses on this. From what I've seen, and these are not peer-reviewed, the fatality rate probably is closer to 0.5 to a little bit under 1%, which is still significant. It's higher than flu, if that's at all a meaningful metric, which I'm not sure it is, because Why it's not a meaningful metric? Because this population has not been exposed to flu. We don't have any of the immunity or the vaccines or the ability to protect ourselves. So even, you know, if we're getting lower fatality rates now with more studies and meta-analyses of existing studies that are lower than 2%, lower than 1%, it's still high enough that over an entire city or country, many, many people can die. So we need to be careful, and just because the number's going down doesn't mean it's not the problem we thought it was.
Dr. Ioannidis, do we get too caught up on the flu discussion?
I think that the discussion with the comparison against the flu has created a lot of confusion because these are different viruses, and as it was pointed out, we don't have a vaccine for coronavirus. Well, we do have a vaccine for the flu. I think it's not easy for people to understand, but it's important to make that point that the risk gradient for flu is very different compared to the risk gradient for coronavirus. So flu is a disease that does kill a lot of children, for example, and young adults. And coronavirus, despite the fact that we have these concerns about Kawasaki syndrome, for example, we don't see it kill children or young adults, except for the unusual situations where you have children or young adults with underlying diseases, you know, with severe immunodeficiency or other reasons that they would be at very high risk. For middle-aged individuals, the risk profile, other things being equal, seems to be about the same. However, once it gets to nursing homes, once it gets to become nosocomial infection, infecting personnel and then spreading within people who are in the hospital, because we don't have a vaccine to protect people in the hospital and the nosocomial, the personnel in healthcare facilities to be vaccinated, then it can become a disaster. So,
okay, wait. I'm going to interrupt and stop you there because we are going to start running out of time. My apologies for that. And I want to get to the one other point involving the president. He raised a lot of eyebrows, and I'll direct this to you, Dr. Eisenman. He's raised a lot of eyebrows by saying that he's been taking for about a week and a half now hydroxychloroquine. But he's also said that, does he think it works? Maybe, maybe not. But he doesn't think it's going to affect his heart because he's a healthy, he says anyway, a healthy guy, and he's taking it in a dose that he says people have been taking for decades now to treat things like lupus. Is he right about that? There are national studies being done as we speak using thousands of people taking this drug, and clearly those studies have not been stopped, so I presume that means nobody has died yet.
Well, so there's sort of two ways of answering the question. On the one hand, there is the personal decision between the patient and the physician, in this case, between the president and his doctor, to take a medication, presumably at the standard dose that's been used with lupus patients. And if that's the case, his doctor has looked at his heart and looked at his risks and made a reasoned decision about the risks and benefits to the president. And we have to trust his physician to have made a good decision for his patient. Now, on the other hand, there's the problem of a president touting hydroxychloroquine for others and saying that this is something others should take and that it's safe. He cannot be making those kinds of statements. And what we've seen in the past when he's made these kinds of statements, for instance, with hydroxychloroquine, is that the medication became hard to get for people who needed it because others who didn't need it were rushing out to get it filled for themselves. So my lupus patients were actually having a hard time getting refills of hydroxychloroquine when this first happened several months ago. So at the population level, the president should not be making unfounded claims for the drug.
Dr. David Eisenman, UCLA, Dr. John Ioannidis at Stanford, thanks to you both.
When we continue, is it safe to go into the water at the beach? You're listening to KNX In Depth. He's Mike Simpson. I'm Charles Feldman.
The beach has been a focus of protests and reopening efforts in Southern California, particularly Orange County. But what if the beaches are super spreaders of this virus? One study from UC San Diego finds ocean breezes can kick up the particulate matter. So should people be worried about spending time in the water on the sand? Katie Day, Surfrider Foundation's staff scientist. Katie, what do you think? Which is it? Are we worried about the breeze, or is being out in the open air with the sunshine better because it just spreads everything out?
Hi there. Thanks for having me. Right now, I would say, based on the available evidence and research that's out there, there's no confirmed risk of sea spray causing an increased risk of COVID transmission at the beach.
So here's a kind of a different question, but also about the beach, because in some parts of California where the beach is open, we're being told, we're being told that it's okay to go in the water and swim, but not hang out on the beach and, you know, sunbathe. But yet in other beaches that are going to be open, we're told the opposite, that it's not okay to go in the water, but it is okay to stay on the beach. I mean, so, like, which is it?
So I think it's important to note that there are still a lot of research gaps when it comes to COVID-19 and or the COVID-19 virus, we'll say, when it comes to beach water. Right now, it's become clear with recent case studies that the risk of outdoor transmission is much lower than it is in indoor environments. So the general consensus is that if you go to the beach and you keep your distance, you know, that recommended 6-foot distance from other beachgoers, the likelihood of getting sick is very low. And that's just based on what we currently know. I think the main point, the driving difference between those two statements that you recommended or that you mentioned is that we still don't know if the coronavirus COVID-19 is able to remain viable and infectious in salt water. And the main way and mechanism for the virus to get into salt water would be through sewage-polluted waterways. Unfortunately, raw and undertreated sewage frequently reaches our beaches due to stormwater runoff or sewer line bursts and spills. And that sewage, there's concern that the sewage may be able to have the infectious virus within it. Now, we know that sewage does contain the RNA of the virus if there are infected individuals in that service area, but it hasn't been confirmed if that virus is actually able to be infectious. It needs both an intact RNA as well as an intact outer envelope, and we just haven't seen any research or studies that confirm the presence of an intact outer envelope. So if sewage is not infectious, and if the virus is unable to remain viable in saltwater, then I don't see how there could be an increased risk of swimming in seawater for COVID-19 transmission.
Okay, so now just kind of same advice as everywhere else, which is just distance yourself from people, whether you're getting in the water or whether you're on the sand, or just like the rules, at least for LA County, which is keep it moving, right? This is not a time to sunbathe yet, but you walk or you run, that kind of thing.
Exactly. Sunbathing, you know, in itself inherently isn't a dangerous practice, but sunbathing could increase your likelihood for being in close proximity to other people. So I think that's kind of the main driving force for this push for active recreation and not people, you know, sitting it and parking in the sand. Also, when you go and you park it in the sand for a long period of time, that's going to increase your likely reliance and need for other services and facilities at the beach. For instance, if you need to use the restroom.
Yeah.
Which could then increase your risk of transmission by touching potentially contaminated surfaces.
Katie Day, Surf Rider Foundation. Katie, thanks.
So the pandemic apparently is, among other things, for some people, bringing out the absolute worst. Some people are being just really, like, mean to other people. I mean, it's like they're nasty. Is it fear or something more?
This is KNX In Depth, Mike Simpson and Charles Feldman.
So how many of you have sort of witnessed this kind of scene? You know, like someone's walking along, right, and they're not wearing a mask, and somebody else is walking along and they're wearing a mask, and the person wearing the mask says to the person not wearing the mask in a kind of nasty way, "Hey, you!"
And then words are exchanged.
Yeah, the mask on, that kind of thing. And then the person who's not wearing the mask goes, "No, I don't want to put on a mask."
Yeah. Or you could just go on the internet, because everyone's fighting there.
Aren't they always? Well, you know, look, everyone's been on edge because of the pandemic, and it is causing some people to act like, well, how can we say this diplomatically? Jerks. Some people are making scenes at stores for refusing to wear a mask. People who wear a mask are being called sheep. And then, of course, there's quarantine shaming, which has been a thing on social media.
John Patrick Allum, director of the Social Media Analytics Lab for Keck Medicine of USC. I guess we're not surprised. This is what happens. We're people. We do this. But if we can't be nice to each other during a pandemic, are we ever going to be nice to each other?
Right. Well, you know, we're living and operating in a time with a lot of uncertainty, and that raises anxiety and our frustrations. And I think it would be the best time to kind of, you know, practice the golden rule and kind of ask yourself, would you like to be treated this way? And in hopes to kind of guide your behavior in the small interactions that we have with one another right now.
You know, I kind of wonder if a few years now of social media experience that we all have under our belts, where people tend to be a lot more vocal and open about their hostility, certainly on things like Twitter and maybe Facebook as well, if that's now starting to spill over into actual real life situations, and the pandemic is bringing that out in us.
Well, that's the chicken or the egg issue. You know, are we frustrated to then go online to express those frustrations? So we have this kind of causal direction that way. Alternatively, we're looking at our feeds or browsing blogs and seeing a lot of kind of frustration being expressed, and then that builds up and we might take that offline. And so the important thing to be thinking about when comparing online to offline behavior is that, you know, these ugly instances, will potentially get a lot of attention. And it's not necessarily reflective of what is going on. You know, if you were to really monitor individual interactions at a grocery store or at a what would used to be a popular crosswalk, most of the interactions are innocuous. In other words, they're really nothing to write home about. But if people are looking for a story or looking to express frustration, you know, they'll hyper focus on an event where they've seen inappropriate behavior or something undesirable.
Yeah, and it's always going to get posted something from somewhere, and you have Facebook and Twitter and YouTube trying to break up the fight, so at least go after misinformation, but it's not always going to happen. Something's always going to be up there for us to argue about.
Yes, and we see that. I see that constantly on the data that I'm collecting and in my own personal life. When you think about certain community online platforms like Nextdoor, the issue of the importance of wearing a mask, not wearing a mask, and if someone walks to their car and forgets it, but wears it in all other instances of the day, you know, you can always find someone or find an individual who, you know, might not be doing the exact right thing. And if now with social media, people are being monitored so often. And if you're doing this gotcha kind of neighborhood policing, you'll always find someone to do the wrong thing. And, you know, whether or not we want to draw a lot of attention to that is really the question. And you know, why individuals aren't going to the internet to suggest that, you know, everyone's doing the right thing and everyone's practiced social distancing on average. You know, that isn't all that expressive or potentially interesting.
We like the fight. John Patrick Allam, Director of Social Media Analytics Lab, Keck Medicine, USC. Be nice.
Yeah, people be nice. Be nice like Mike and me. We're always nice to each other. Just make sure you wipe that down, please.
Yes. That's all. Talk to you after the show.